Should we go again?
All right.
Okay. Welcome to COVID Island Dramas, a variation on a well-known theme. I'm Karen Archer, and I'm delighted to be asking a special guest which 8 radio dramas they take away with them while isolating on their own COVID island. And this week, we're talking to Andy Jordan, award-winning theatre and radio director, producer, one-time bricklayer and general theatre polymath. Welcome, Andy.
Hello, and thank you for having me here to do this programme. It's splendid.
So let's start at the beginning. Your working class background on a council estate in Southampton. So you left school at 15. And although you'd always sworn you'd never follow your father into bricklaying, that's exactly what you did until your early 20s. But you were part of a pop group. So tell us about the Walking Dogs.
Yes, I will. I was indeed in a rhythm and blues pop group aged 14 and 15. I played bass guitar really badly. We were called the Walking Dogs after the Rufus Thomas song, Walking the Dog.
Right.
I met the other members of the band for the first time at a Beatles gig. That's honestly true. Where I also got to meet the Beatles. We were approached outside the theatre by a journalist from the Daily Mirror who asked us to attend a Rolling Stones gig, which was coming up in a couple of weeks' time, and to hold up banners slagging off the Beatles. The resulting photographs appeared on the front page of the Daily Mirror.
No.
So we decided that fame beckoned and that we should be a band. At our first gig in a cinema, people threw things at us. So we rightfully threw them back. We spent most of our time running away from our different schools playing truant and travelling to London, where we sometimes had to beg for money on the street.
Good Lord.
Because we had no money and we had no food. The group ended its career very ignominiously with our rhythm guitarist being sent back to Borstal for a botched raid on a London music shop. This is absolutely true. The rest of us knew about his plan, and so we were implicated. We were brought up before the chief constable, who gave us a right old dressing down, you can imagine.
Yeah.
All of this was reported in the local paper, so two of the band's families instantly emigrated from shame. One went to Canada and the other to Australia. Our drummer ended up being the drummer in Elton John's band. I, however, ended up on a bus, aged 15, going into town, very despondently thinking my life was over.
Oh, Andy, that's just a wonderful story. It's quite wonderful. You really couldn't make that up. Just, you know, bring us back for a moment. I don't want to, really. Your love of plays began when you randomly saw Sing's Playboy of the Western World on the family TV set.
I was aged 6. It was the day that our first television was delivered and was being installed. I guess there's a sense in which that was the day that I decided I wanted to be an actor. I sat in front of the TV, probably about 6 inches from it, and there was a section of a play on, and it concerned a young man, a dreamer and a fantasist called Christie, who had a bullying father whom one day he turned on, taking a shovel to his father's head. He escapes and finds himself in a village high up in the Irish hills. Then one day, and this is where I started watching the play, we see an old angry man coming up the hillside, his head swathed in bandages, carrying a shovel. I didn't know what the play was then, and had almost forgotten about it for the next 14 years. Then when I was aged 20 and at technical college doing a drama diploma course, our tutor handed a play to us, which we were to read there and then. It was J.M. Sing's The Playboy of the Western World, and I was asked to read the role of Christy Mahon, And in that moment, I realised that my life had come full circle.
Extraordinary.
And that I was finally exactly where I'd always wanted to be.
Yeah, amazing. So your education really began, as you say, with a drama diploma, bricklaying, paying the way. Then in 1973, you enrolled as a mature student at Bristol University. And you graduated in 1976, and that was when your long association with the Edinburgh Fringe Festival began. You ran one of the first multi-space venues, and collaborators included Quentin Crisp, Angus Deaton, Rory McGrath, Chris Langham, Jim Broadbent, Alexei Sale. So, did you have a conscious knowledge by this stage that directing and producing were now to be the core of your professional life?
Well, on the face of it, yes. Secretly, and I probably didn't talk to anybody about this, I still had this passionate desire to be an actor and to go to drama school. Even going to university, in a way, was a change of plan, because when I went to the technical college, I was actually only going because I had to have a couple of A-levels in order to be able to get to drama school.
Right.
And the truth is, I was tricked into applying to do drama at university by my tutor, the same woman who'd given us that play to read. She said to me, she said, Andy, have you thought about university? And I remember swearing, because there was a part of me, the bricklayer part of me, that didn't like students, that still kind of thought that they were all kind of lazy and didn't have to work for a living. And I explained this to her, and she said, oh, well, look, Andy, don't worry. Getting into university to do drama is enormously competitive, and you wouldn't stand a chance.
Wonderful.
And of course, that was, you know, red rag to a bull. So I applied to the five or six universities that did drama in those days. And the final one that I was going to interview for was Bristol. And I got off the train, and I loved Bristol from the time it had taken me to walk from the station to the department. I'd fallen in love with it. And I thought, please, 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 please take me. And they did.
I'm going to stop you right there, because it's now time to hear your first choice of play. And why have you chosen it?
John Dryden. He is one of the very best audio drama directors there has ever been. I could choose almost anything of his, but if I have to choose just one, and I do, it will be his wonderful 1998 location recorded dramatization of Charles Dickens' Bleak House.
Understand me, my dear girl, I had no doubt of your being contented and happy with me, but I saw with whom you would be happy.
No, no.
He loves you, and you love him. But I would not have my Esther break her promise. This is Bleak House. This day, I give this house its little mistress. And before God, it is the brightest day in all my life.
Thank you, Guardian. Thank you.
Come, come. Would you like to see your future husband?
Yes, I would like that very much.
Hush, hush.
My happiness was complete in every respect but one. I so wished for Ada and Richard to be settled and content. We were to be married before the month was out, and before this, the Jarndyce and Jarndyce cause was to come on. I hoped and I prayed for the future happiness of Richard and Ada that a judgment would now come.
Yeah, so lovely to be reminded of that production.
Really, just lovely, beautiful, beautiful. So immediately after graduation, your professional career began as an acting ASM at the iconic Theatre Royal at Stratford East. Did you meet Joan Littlewood?
Yes, I did. And I have to say it was one of the most thrilling things for me at that time. I did get to meet her. She'd just retired. She just stopped being the artistic director. But Joan was still about at that time. Now, of course, I've taught her work over many, many years, and hopefully have inspired young people to get as excited about her and theatre workshop as I was and still am.
Right. Now, time to listen to your second piece. What have you chosen?
James Robinson, definitely also in my top five audio drama directors. There are, again, so many productions of his I could choose, but I particularly like the five series of tracks. And if I have to choose one production, It will be from Origin, written by Matthew Broughton.
When I first saw it, I think it was flying level with the Earth, parallel, but losing altitude. Is that possible? I knew it was falling.
And you dialed 999 at that point?
I think so.
We have it on record.
There's a plane coming down much too fast.
What's your location, please?
Penbury, south of the airfield.
I was staring at it, mesmerised. As it got lower, it turned. And then it seemed to accelerate at an angle. And it sort of lurched to one side. I thought it was going to impact on the beach and the water, but it hit before then. It hit the field. It was a small plane, but suddenly seemed huge on the ground, ripping up the earth. The momentum drove it forward. One of the wings took out a herd of cows. They didn't move. They were wiped out in half a second. And the other wing hit five or six caravans from the park site on the other side. They crumpled like they were made of paper. There was metal and cow flesh, a wrenching.
I love those series as well. I thought they were wonderful. Now, your next big step really came in the late 1970s when you founded Bristol Express Company, specialising in new writing. That ran until 1994. And in that time, you directed and or produced over 40 new plays.
Yes. So there are lots and lots and lots of memories of Bristol Express. The particular shows that I remember, one of the first things that I directed for the company and that won a Scotsman Edinburgh Festival Fringe First Award was a play called Lunatic and Lover by Michael Mayer about August Strindberg. Another play that I remember with great fondness was Theory for the Attention of Mr. Einstein by Paul Unwin, who subsequently, of course, went on to create Casualty on television. Another production that I have to mention, and Jonathan wouldn't forgive me if I didn't, one of the other earliest things that Bristol Express did when we weren't doing arty plays, we were doing popular entertainment. And one of those most successful plays was Elsie and Norm's Macbeth, written by John Christopher Wood, who was an actor. And in fact, he used to play Norman in our original productions. I first was involved in it when it was first done in Bath in a church hall. We then did it in Edinburgh, and John lost his voice. And another actor in the company, making his professional debut, a man called Alex Jennings, took over playing Norman Grindthorpe in Elsie and Norm's Macbeth. After that, we used to revive the play every few years, and we tore it, and it would make us money allow us to do the difficult new plays. Yes. And the final thing I think of very fondly was a programme of work we did called The Plays the Thing. Between 1986 and 1994, a massive series of play readings, workshop productions, and fully staged productions, which used to run annually. Altogether, we did 60 new plays by new writers at theatres across London, the Almeida, the Half Moon, the Royal Court, and countless others. Those are the three productions that stand out from the 40-odd shows that we did.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, look, we're coming to your third choice. Can you tell us about this?
This is where I play something from one of my own radio drama productions, and it is The Night of the Hunter, the James Agee novel dramatised by John Fletcher, Stuart Roger as the psychotic preacher, and Tom Lawrence and Angela Shafto as the brilliant children.
Listen, Pearl, you and me is running off tonight.
Why?
If we stay here, something awful will happen to us.
Will Daddy Powell take care of us?
No, he won't. He won't.
Karen!
Where are we going, John?
I ain't right thought yet. Somewhere.
Okay, John.
We thread our way under. Scared Pearl might trip over. Shout out.
I'm hungry, John.
Don't worry, Pearl. We'll steal something to eat.
It'll spoil our supper.
Where are you? Pearl?
Stay down, Pearl. Stay down.
Okay, John.
I can hear you whispering, children. I know you're down there. I can feel myself getting awful mad.
The man. White shirt on. Black trousers. Black hair. Carrying a candle. Come softly down the cellar stairs. In his other hand, his shining knife.
George!
Shh. I'm coming to get you, children. My patience has run out.
That's terrifying.
And those children were amazing. Yes. They were astonishing.
It sounded brilliant. I want to talk about your unfinished business with drama school and your slightly bewildering but undiminished desire to be an actor. You enrolled at Webber Douglas Drama School. What happened?
God, yes. A rather bizarre story. Yes, I agree completely. So, as you know, I had this sense from the time I was six that I wanted to escape and be an actor. I finally decided that I would stop directing and stop producing and go to drama school. At the interview, the principal, Raphael Jago, was concerned, and I reassured him it would be fine, and I cancelled all my upcoming directing commitments. I was going to be an actor. However, by the time day one at Webber Douglas arrived, one of our Edinburgh Festival shows had been picked up by the West End producers Brian Ricks and Ray Cooney and was opening at the end of the second week of term. So within a couple of days, I decided that I had to leave the school. The principal was not pleased. Three or four weeks after that, the show had opened and closed.
It was
not a hit. And I then realised I had nothing to do as I'd cancelled all my directing commitments. I phoned the principal and he straight away said, "Hi, Andy, we thought you might phone. And yes, you can come back." So I did go back and I started to have a lot of fun. Ironically, after all that, I didn't complete the course because I was seduced back into directing and joining the Manchester Royal Exchange Theatre as a director. So I didn't finish my second year.
And then you were invited to do the BBC Film and TV Directors course. This was in the 1980s.
Yes.
And was that exciting? Was that more so than theatre and radio? I mean,
yes. I was thrilled. It was an incredibly exciting bunch of people. And we had an amazing time. The story, however, has a sort of twist in its tail because I discovered that I didn't like working in television drama. And particularly, I didn't like the people who worked in television drama. Ruthless, backstabbing people. And I very quickly went back to theatre where, you know, by and large, people are civilised and committed to the work.
Really interesting story. I didn't know that at all. Now, look, we're halfway through, Andy. Time for your fourth choice. What's it going to be?
It's a clip from one of Dirk Maggs's comedies. Again, I could have chosen almost anything of his. He's one of the best radio drama and radio entertainment directors there has ever been. I'm particularly fond of his Adventures of Superman, Neverwhere, which I believe featured you.
Yes, I was in it in a very small way. I was indeed.
But actually, I've chosen a clip from one of his comedy series, Shyster, Flywheel and Shyster, based on a 1933 Marx Brothers radio show of the same name. Michael Roberts, Lorelei King and Frank Lazarus.
This is ridiculous, Miss Dimple. I sent Ravelli out over an hour ago for lunch and he's not back yet. How long can it take to steal cheese from a rat trap? That's probably him now.
I beg your pardon?
Ravelli, you've changed. There's something different about you. No, don't tell me. Let me guess. I know you've grown a beard. Now run along and tie your dog up outside.
Asher no dog, Asher me, boss.
Oh, so that's you, Ravelli. Well, run along and tie your woman up outside.
Hey, Mr. Flywheel, this is a Mrs. Thorndyke. She wants to see you.
Is this a detective agency?
A detective agency? Madam, if there is anything in it for me, this is Scotland Yard.
This man told me he was taking me to a detective bureau.
Ah, you're cuckoo. I did not. You stop me in the hall. You say you want a detective. I say you go see Flywheel. You say, all right, well, here's a Flywheel.
Sir, are you or aren't you a detective? My time is money.
It is? Could you lend me 10 minutes for lunch? How about half an hour for the rent?
For the last time, are you a detective?
Madam, for the first time, I am a detective.
Well, you don't look much like a detective to me.
That's the beauty of it. See, I had you fooled already.
Is this man who brought me in a detective, too?
Sure, I'm a detective. I prove it. Lady, you lose anything today?
Why, I don't think so. Heavens, my handbag has disappeared.
Here it is.
Where did you find it?
Right here, in my pocket.
Isn't he marvelous, madam? He has the nose of a bloodhound. And his other features aren't so bad either. Why, just last week, he followed a woman clear across town on a case.
Sure. Next time I take a taxi, it's a quicker.
Brilliant. I love it. Now, for the next 12 years, your life was overwhelmingly involved with radio drama. You were BBC senior radio drama producer based in Bristol, Birmingham and London. You organised the BBC Carlton Hobbs Student Radio Drama Award, and you also ran the radio drama Young Playwrights Festival and the World Service International Festival. Two Sony International Awards, two Giles Cooper Awards, a New York Radio Festival Award, and the EU Broadcasting Union Award. That not to be sneezed at.
It's important for me to acknowledge my collaborators, the actors, composers, studio managers. Let me start by mentioning the writers, all of whom I often worked with, John Fletcher, Craig Warner, and Neil Mackay. They're the three writers of the three clips from my own productions.
So tell me about your fifth choice. And this is the second, I think, of your own productions, if I've got that right.
Yes. from a Craig Warner play this time, By Where the Old Shed Used to Be. I'm very proud to say it won a Giles Cooper Award and was published by Matthew and Books. This was the second of a number of plays I did with Craig, who is one of the most remarkable writers I have ever worked with. This clip features Miranda Richardson and Siobhan Redmond. The play was inspired by the Brothers Grimm version of Cinderella, which was, as you know, a bloody, terrifying version of the story.
Indeed.
In our heightened, rather iconoclastic version, Adelaide is one of the ugly sisters and Sarah is Cinderella.
I'm here, Adelaide! Get away from the egg! Sarah, you mouse putt! Heavenly angel, watch your sister dance.
Come here, grab my hand.
Get all her fingers off.
I can't hear you. Come closer.
No, no. No more tricks. You've won now. Finish it off.
Adelaide.
Too rough, but oh, so clear.
I want you to come with us.
There's nothing left of me.
Live with us. I want you.
The way a cat wants a mouse. You've got blood on your claws.
Come with me. I'll serve you every minute of the day.
Do you think we can start again? My sister got her hand off.
You are in a dangerous place.
What's a dangerous place? She's dead.
Grab my hand. You're killing me.
Oh, too late. I've got the music in my feet. I don't want to go now. My future's all in front of me, shining like a crow's eye. Watch your sister down!
Adelaide!
and Mother can't dance anymore because her feet don't touch the ground. She's up on the wall now, hanging from a peg. A clock's wrinkly, calling out the strokes of 12.
Come over here! Dance with me!
You went under 3 times.
Yeah, but who's counting my
dead? You won, Sarah! I'm dancing for you!
You're kidding me!
Dancing for you, Sarah! I'm dancing for you!
Well, that's quite terrifying.
Yes.
Just the intention. Very, very powerful. Very powerful. All right. Another milestone. The founding of Andy Jordan Productions in 2000, a company still running today. Again, you've specialised in new writing, taking 42 productions, I think, across the country and around the world. Just give us a flavour of a couple of the more memorable productions, if you can.
Yes. And may I say, before I do, that a certain Karen Archer
<What's coming?
laughs> has acted in more Andy Jordan productions than any other actor.
Oh my goodness, is this true?
It's absolutely true. it might not be something that you're particularly proud of.
I'm actually rather stunned and rather touched, I must say. But it's not about me, so we're moving on. But that's rather wonderful.
So, a couple of things, a couple of shows of the many that we've done that stand out. A bit like with Bristol Express, you know, one of the first shows we did. In fact, the first production was the world premiere of a cycle of 8 one-woman shows, Picasso's Women by Brian McAvera.
Wonderful.
They were dramatic monologues about the women in Picasso's life. We had the most astonishing casts in the various iterations of the production. Jerry Hall, Toya Wilcox, Josie Lawrence, Gwen Taylor, Susanna York, Sherry Longhi. Another thing I feel I ought to mention is about Professor Carl Gerassi, the man who synthesized the contraceptive pill, who developed cortisone, who developed antihistamines, and very late in life decided to become a playwright.
He did.
And we did 10 plays together, the world premieres of 10 plays. Another production I will remember with great fondness, I love doing, as a co-production with the Hackney Empire Theatre, directed by Susie McKenna, music by the jazz star Orphy Robinson, The Midsummer Night's Madness. It was a hip-hop version of Midsummer Night's Dream, which I absolutely adored doing. It had a cast of 23, a lot of younger people who were members of various youth theatres and developmental workshops and so on at the Hackney Empire, and local musicians and dancers. And it was the most incredibly moving and funky and funny piece of work. I loved it.
Lovely, lovely. Time for extract number 6. What have you chosen here?
This is an extract from a play that was directed by Adrian Bean, another hugely talented radio drama director, writer and adapter, one of the finest around. The play is from Bomber, a truly brilliant dramatisation by Joe Dunlop of Len Deighton's novel about a Second World War bombing raid on Germany.
It's nearly 4. I have to go.
Oh, you've missed crew supper.
I'd rather spend the time with you.
You look tired.
Don't wait for me tonight.
In less than 2 hours, the 16 Lancasters will take off from Worley Fen, and the German flak and night fighters will be waiting for them. As Sam Lambert walked away from his wife that afternoon, he was afraid. Afraid he would never see her again.
But one girl was engaged, and her boyfriend was to have finished his tour of ops. And they were going to get married that week. And the very last of his first tour, he was shot down.
I said, "You're married and you've got 2 young kids. He said, "I know." He said, "But I'm not worried." He said, "God will look after me." He said, "He knows my wife and 2 kids, they're dependent on me." He got the chop that night.
In Krefeld, as afternoon turns to evening, the band of the local Bund Deutscher Mädchen has almost finished its march. Today, as every Saturday, they have been collecting donations of money, food and clothing for bombed-out people. The girls are cold and tired now, but it's been worth it. People will need hot soup and warm clothing if the British come over tonight.
Oh, that's so powerful in its understatedness.
Deeply, deeply moving piece of work.
Yeah, well, wonderful. So in 2005, you took up a new challenge, Lincoln University. Tell us something about life at the university.
It was a big challenge for me in many ways. I ran my professional career alongside my teaching, directing as a freelance and directing with Andy Jordan Productions, which was challenging. It was also rewarding and at times exciting. Introduce the students to radio drama. One of the first modules that I wrote was acting for camera and acting for audio. And I think it's true to say that many of the students, probably most of the students, had never listened to radio drama. But I can say, hand on heart, and this is very interesting, that most years we had more students wanting to, as it were, matriculate in radio drama than in camera. And that was very gratifying, and it was lovely.
Really?
You know, they discovered a medium that they didn't know about, the majority of them didn't, but they discovered how exciting it can be. Creatively, it is in many ways the most exciting of all the media, because, of course, it's only in audio and radio that you can do anything and go anywhere. All the other media, theatre, film, television, absolutely, is circumscribed by practical things like resources and locations and so on. In radio, if it can be imagined, it can be created. For me, there are no surprises that many of the world's greatest writers not only start in radio, but they continue to work in radio. For example, Harold Pinter's last play was not a theatre play, it was a radio play. So I must be honest and say that I never regarded myself as an academic. I always thought of myself as a practitioner working in the academy. So one of the things I did very, very early was to create a company, which in fact is at the heart of everything all the students at the school do. It was a company that had both an undergraduate arm and a professional arm, so that students, when they were undergraduates, did work. And when they graduated, they went into the professional company. And we toured that work. We took it abroad to Poland, to America, to Ireland. We did seasons, 6-7 shows every year at the Edinburgh Festival. We did co-productions with theatres throughout Lincolnshire. And it was that kind of work that probably is the stuff that I enjoyed most and where I felt, in a way, most at home.
Your last but one choice of play. Tell us.
Yes. This is taken from my rock and roll season, All Shook Up, A City Called Glory.
Right.
Written by the remarkable Neil Mackay, about the iconic Sam Cooke. The scene features a song that became a civil rights anthem, Change Is Gonna Come.
You want to hear it, Alex?
Oh, this is your protest song, huh? Your Dylan song.
Yeah. Long overdue. I mean, I've done it, haven't I? It was me. It was me, not Dylan, got busted up in Shreveport.
So, go ahead. Play it.
What do you think?
Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living.
Alex.
I got nothing to say.
Blame me.
All you can say about a song like this is... Listen. It's a goddamn anthem, Sam. It's a goddamn anthem.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
All the while, the Copa date's coming closer. And it still feel like this thing gonna show itself to him. What is it? He still can't tell. So dream on.
I'm very glad you chose that. That's wonderful. So, Andy, you left Lincoln in 2019, perfectly timed for the beginning of a world pandemic. What's on your calendar now? What's on your radar? What's in your head?
Well, like everybody in our industry, I've been forced to adapt. I need to keep working. I need to be busy to keep anxiety at bay as much as anything else. So I instantly decided I wanted to do some radio drama remotely. I put together a project based on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The other thing I decided I wanted to do was to explore digital theatre. Zoom plays. People were beginning to do work on Zoom and on the internet.
Indeed.
So we did. The first of which, SpaceX Pat by Vince Licata, won an award, which was lovely. Apart from that, we've been continuing to develop theatre work. I've been developing radio drama proposals. And we're actually also now in discussions to see if we can't get some of our shows together for the live Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Season that starts in August is very short notice. There are still lots of uncertainties. We're hoping that we might be able to get some live theatre back together again. So that's
right.
It.
Wonderful. Well, wishing you all the best of luck with all of that, obviously. So getting towards the end here to your final choice. So tell us about this.
Yes. So clip 8. Comes from an Australian production, from a wonderful play called The Summer of the Aliens, written by one of Australia's greatest playwrights, Louis Naura. I loved this production. I found it intensely textured, moving, imaginative, honest, and evocative. Its filmic use of sound and location recording was utterly superb. Both the play and the production had a very strong influence on me in my earliest days as a radio drama producer.
When we passed the dark side of the moon, they gave me apples to eat.
What sort of apples?
Just like on Earth, but crispier.
That was the year I developed an obsession with flying saucers.
And then you went on to Venus?
We went to Venus. Inside Venus, there's a gigantic city. People can fly. They think flying, then they fly. They are not like men and women like us. They are all the same sex.
Are they clean people?
Yes, very clean.
So how do they breed?
I didn't ask them. They told me they'd tell me next time.
So there will be a next time?
Very soon they're going to take me back there for a longer stay. I said I couldn't be away from work too long.
Then they flew you back?
Yes. They told me that a lot of them live amongst us. They're collecting information.
For invasion?
I don't know. They were kind to me.
Sometimes I couldn't get to sleep. Especially when it was hot and the telephone wires would sing and hum really loudly. I used to wonder if aliens spoke like the telephone wires. I thought about aliens a lot that year.
Me a bit after this, mate.
Well, you two get back, you're putting me off. Why do they hang around?
To get the brass cast.
Oh. Well, we are about to send you off to your very own island, Andy. Do you have a piece of music that either slows your heart rate, gives you pleasure, raises your spirits?
Yes. You know, this has been almost more difficult than choosing eight playing radio dramas. And, you know, and I spent probably hours, and it was very enjoyable, combing back through all my favourite artists. Anyway, I finally decided to go back to when I first started to buy singles, 45s, and LPs. And the two artists and songs that are fighting between themselves are Georgie Fame, with the Harry South Big Band and a fantastic album he made in 1966 called Sound Venture, and Nancy Wilson, one of the greatest jazz stylists ever, and her album Lush Life, which was released in 1967, which I bought. And I think I'm probably going to go with Nancy Wilson, whom, incidentally, I got to meet at the Lewisham Town Hall.
No.
She was part of a jazz bill at the Lewisham Town Hall. She was fabulous. She was down to earth, kind. I mean, you know, one of those lovely meetings when you meet a hero and they're everything you want them to be.
Your lips were like a red and ruby chalice, warmer than a summer night. The clouds were like an alabaster palace, rising to a snowy height. Each star its own aurora borealis. Suddenly you held me tight. I could see the midnight sun. I can't explain the silver rain that found me. Oh, was that a moonlit veil? The music of the universe around me. Oh, was that a nightingale? And then your arms miraculously found me. Suddenly the sky turned pale.
What a voice! What a voice that woman has.
Oh, she's absolutely astonishing, but just the most luscious voice.
Mm. Yes, wonderful. Now look, finally, your best COVID moment. Is there such a thing?
Yes.
Tell us.
My children last year, they came to Lincoln for my birthday. They brought loads of food and presents and decorations. The plan, of course, was that we were going to be in the garden and eat outside and all of that. And of course, it being Lincoln, it was windy and rainy.
Of course.
And Phoebe brought so much food. She's a wonderful cook. And so anyway, it was incredibly touching for me. And that's my COVID memory.
That's wonderful. Andy Jordan, what can I say? Thank you so much for sharing with us your COVID island dramas. Thank you.
Thank you very, very, very much.